¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1258.OB0102, certificate number 50858, surrealistic prank calls.
Hey, is your refrigerator running?
Yes, it is.
Hello, Aaron.
Hey, John, how's it going?
Good. Where are you right now?
Don't you know I'm coming at you from sunny, mildly sunny Los Angeles, California? The only place I've seen you live ever in my life. Multiple times. I've seen a moving John. This is the third time. Mm-hmm. But I've seen you do a podcast here. I've seen you play a show here on a piano, no less.
Whoa, you weren't at that show.
I was at the Regent, yes.
The show where I like halfway through the song stopped and said, please forgive me, and started again, yeah. and then did it again, and I think maybe did it a third time.
Yeah. It was like, there's that really good line from Mean Girls, like seeing a dog on its hind legs. Like, yeah. This is the dog I know, but it's just, it's in a weird... I love it. It was great. It was really special.
I'm glad. Yeah. The way the show was pitched to me was we're going to get a bunch of songwriters that don't normally play the piano, and we're going to get them up there and just put them in front of a piano, and they're going to play their songs, but on an instrument they don't normally play.
Yeah.
And I showed up, and there's whatever it was, 6 other musicians. Mm-hmm. Every one of them a genius piano player who just didn't play piano in their band, but, you know, posed on it, and there was no piano that I could rehearse on in the backstage or anywhere in the venue. So I showed up, flew in from Seattle, had a cold, and then walked out on stage like, I've never seen a piano before.
Yeah. And you owned it, though.
I really was twisting. I was twisting in the wind, but that's nice. So you are an Angeleno?
Yeah. I'm from West Virginia, mostly based in Pittsburgh throughout my life, but I've lived here on and off for the last 10 years. I'm someone whose lizard brain dictates that their happiness is on a 1-to-1 ratio with how much sun I'm getting.
Oh, that's nice that you learned that about yourself.
Later than I would like, but...
So let's talk a little bit about surrealism as it relates to... your generation, because this is always been a topic, a popular framing on Omnibus, even when it was just Ken and me talking about the difference between being mid-generation X and slightly later mid-generation X. But now we're getting a broader slice of humanity here on the show. And so I'm being introduced to millennial culture from within the minds of millennials, mm-hmm. which is a thing I studiously avoided knowing anything about for now 2 decades. I really didn't want to know. Keep it
I
to
listen
yourselves.
To your podcasts. I know that. I know your prohibitions and your prejudices.
But now here we are, and I feel like I grew up in an era of prank phone calls, but in the Bart Simpson model of either calling someplace you knew and asking if their refrigerator was running.
Yeah.
Or actually going through the phone book and just picking randos out.
Yes.
But because you grew up in a different era of telecom, I'm guessing that it was a different game.
To me, I have tried, and the figure about whom I'll be speaking, Longmont Potion Castle, the surrealist prank phone caller, mm-hmm. might be a Generation X person.
Oh, yeah.
He's an anonymous figure, semi-anonymous.
Oh, no kidding.
There's layers of mystery here.
Is it anonymous because he is so irritating that if people knew who he was, that he would be in danger?
Exactly right. Yeah. But I think, I don't know that prank calling really resonated with millennials. I tried to do it. Maybe if we're attaching types of stereo to mm-hmm. to this demographic, stereotypes to millennials, maybe we're a little too sincere mm-hmm. For prank calling. I know when I tried to do it, I used an E-Bombs World soundboard because I was too craven to use my own voice. And we did exactly as you said, you know, picking a number. And I felt awful. Yeah. I felt so guilt-ridden about it. It felt really wrong to me. But you mentioned the Simpsons style, like, who's there? Ben. Bend over. Is bend over here? You know, this type of thing is one thing that I would like to talk about with you. And during this call, John, comma... I'd like to do a few things,
okay.
right? Like,
all right.
I want to talk to you about the history of prank calling and popular culture, very briefly. What Longmont Potion Castle is, okay. the four types of calls that he specializes in,
okay.
and finally, and I think this is where it gets interesting, I'd love to have a conversation about this. The ethics, as I just kind of mentioned, feeling bad and guilt about calling, the ethics of pranking someone and where pranking is going in the age of, we hate to say it, AI, in the age of bots, in the age of spam.
Where is pranking going? This is not a thing I have thought enough about.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about where we're going, as we all are doing now. And where we're going with AI and media and stuff. But it didn't occur to me that pranking was going to change.
And it might not. So, little teaser for later.
Right.
After the ads.
I am curious about the stereotype, as you say, of millennials and millennial culture being earnest and sincere. And that having really... Because we talk about that quite a bit, as broad strokes, as... for a lot of people my age, representing like a cultural upheaval that maybe we don't, as much as we talk about it, which is so much, maybe we don't talk about it enough, even now, given how much of my culture was not insincere, but was like I grew up in a world where worrying about the feelings of the person you were prank calling wouldn't have occurred to anybody. And I think it was maybe because we thought of the world as being sort of monolithic and conformist and the people that were out there just generally were non-player characters or were moms and dads that deserved what was coming to them or...
Yes.
You know, or they were cops or whatever. They were people that we weren't worried about.
Yeah.
And something happened where I think you guys don't like cops just as much as we didn't like cops, but you were more worried about people's feelings.
Bunch of different ways to take this. I am not a nerd. Even though I'm on this podcast.
Okay, because I'm not a nerd either.
Hey, game recognized.
We're both cools, right?
So, yeah. But that didn't. That's not to say I didn't experience difference as a kid.
Sure.
For probably all types of ways. You know, the type of kid I was basketball kid. I was video games kid. I was music kid primarily. Mm-hmm. And that was Dream Theater, and that was Metallica, but it was also Yes, and it was also Led Zeppelin.
You were an alternative metal kid.
I was.
Uh-huh. Operatic metal.
Well, I don't get the symphonic metal out of here. That's what I say. I don't really know where I'm going with this, other than to say I think I even as a kid, as a sensitive kid, I was sensitive to difference and feeling different, mm-hmm. And so. I think millennials are sincere, casting forward a little later. Like, I grew up in, like, CMJ college and culture. Like, college radio was huge for me. This is the era of Iron and Wine and Chromeo and Meriwether Post Pavilion, Animal you know, these are very sincere things. And I think, anyways, going back to that difference I felt, like, in middle school where everyone is mean to each other, I think trying to prank call someone felt like it was very clear to me that I was becoming the bully or something.
Right.
And that felt wrong. It felt, you know, it felt like making someone feel, different, because what happens during a prank call, and maybe we can get to this, is that you are experiencing in real time, witnessing or by listening or doing it, inflicting it yourself. What's happening psychologically is really interesting, because you are exciting that fight or flight thing that we all have. And as you are doing this, there is a decorum that the interloper, whoever picks up the phone, has to adhere to. There are rules to this, right? And you are violating the rules, but they don't know that yet. And this is what Longmont Potion Castle does really well. And you are gaslighting them super slowly. And what I wanted to do, and what other prank callers do, jerky boys included, again, we'll get to this, is very like punchline driven. But when we get to Longmont, after Jerky Boys, after Crank Yankers and everything that came before it, we're seeing that the punchline is, there are punchlines, but that is not the point. The point is that this is an almost TikTok, Instagram reel style of dopamine, where instead of flicking, you're hearing, you know, a three-act structure of this introduction, and then there's conflict. They're realizing what's going on, and they go through this sort of Dabda-like denial of death, where they're clinging to their dignity, and some folks respond super violently, and some folks say, oh, what do I have to lose? This is how often do we get a phone call during the day? This is delightful. I'm going to play along. So that's the type of non-punchline art that I see happening here.
I think the phones have changed so much, and I think it's maybe hard for people younger than a certain age to fully comprehend that a landline phone in your house felt somewhat to you as a public utility. It was not a personal device. It didn't belong to you exactly. It was when the phone rang, it was like somebody knocking on the door. It wasn't a thing. You almost never just hung up on somebody unless you were really provoked.
Yeah.
And you answered it. Like, you didn't ignore it either, no matter what you were doing. If you were in the bath, if you were in the shower, you ran for the phone.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that the phone had so much more, you know, it's not like there were so many more wonderful phone calls, although there wasn't really spam. It was mostly people that you knew or that had important information for you. And now I have no compunction. The phone rings. Most of the time I don't answer it. If I do, and there's even a pause where you hear a click in the background, I hang up.
You're out. I'm out. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just funny to think back that, because I've actually been prank called in the old days on a landline. And you do. You use the word decorum. There's a script that hello, you know, and I used to say, Roderick residence. Mm. And then, may I help you? I don't understand what you're trying to say. Are you looking for, like, you stay in the game.
Yeah.
A long time, because it's possible that the person is confused, that the lines are getting crossed, that, we'll talk, I'm sure, later about the future of pranking, but I feel like we have to be at the end of this era of cell phone. The way we're communicating now is not going to be the way we communicate in a decade, I don't think.
It's a closed form. It's a closed form. It's no longer active. We can't do it anymore. History of pranking and popular culture. No, okay, so there isn't just aperture out 10,000 feet in the air. There isn't a single agreed upon answer to, like, what's the first prank call? But the earliest documented prank calling activity dates to the 1870s, almost immediately after the telephone's public rollout. One standout in the earliest printed account of a prank phone call known to historians, this is great, is a caller who would repeatedly call undertakers to falsely report deaths and send them on a wild goose chase for coffins and funeral supplies. There's a really great Atlas Obscura article about this, which is cool because those were traceable calls. The only anonymous calls came from phones stationed at something like a pharmacy. The switchboard could trace everything back. That's the first note. Again, I'm going quick. Middle period. In terms of tech, not in terms of time, in terms of technology, let's talk about the tube bar recordings. So we're around the 1970s now. These are the types of phone calls you mentioned earlier where you're calling a bar. The tube bar was a real bar. And so, someone would call and, you know, what's a good one? The Simpsons use these all the time.
Yeah.
Hey, would ya? Hey, would ya is my very favorite because it's so implausible that's someone's name.
Hey, would ya? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Hey, would ya.
Although you get when pranking was enough of a thing, you do get your ear gets attuned to that kind of wordplay, but there's always somebody that can say it just right that you don't catch the.
That's where the artistry comes in, I think.
It is an art. It is.
Modern period. Let's talk about this. So this is what I think is a dark time for prank phone calling. I don't have a high opinion of the Jerky Boys, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
We're in the late 80s. This is very unsuspecting victim, vulgar language, which I've never used, just punchline-driven calls that are sort of... punish the elderly and the unsuspecting. To me, that's not funny, right?
No.
There's no art to that. We get to Crank Yankers eventually, which combines celebrity with puppetry and pranking, which is okay. I remember discovering Ween from that show, so that was cool for me.
Sure, this arguably their entire career was a prank, but yeah.
Okay, we're going to fight about that later. This is the Baba Booey era, right? Like, I don't have a high opinion of it either, although I do like Crank Yankers, as I said. Let's talk about Longmont Potion Castle.
We're already to Longmont Potion Castle.
How'd you like it? Was it swift?
I mean, you got us there.
I
feel like the difference between kind of the first example you used... and the later stuff is that there are prank calls that actually send people on wild goose chases where it is using their resources. Like, it's more than just a mind prank. It's a thing that is causing, like, either a normal or maybe a bad victim,
yeah,
somebody who deserves it. But it's actually causing a disruption in their real life day and not just annoying them on the phone.
And that disruption, I really hate to continue to tease this later, but the ethics of that are so interesting, right? Not to be all Ezra Klein about it, but like the attention economy is a thing, right? We're retroactively looking back on the last whatever however many years of capitalism and saying the true wealth is abundance or attention. And to take someone's attention away from them is not harm. It sounds a little, you know, intense to put it that way.
Well, but it's there expensive, is a type of harm. Right?
Yes, it's
particularly
expensive.
If time is wealth,
yes.
Then wasting time is expensive.
Yeah. Is grifting someone, is hoodwinking someone.
So we're in the 80s, we're in the 90s now. Pranking right. has become, yeah, like I remember the Jerky Boys. We listened to them on tour of all the weird,
yeah.
You know, we used to listen to comedy records and stuff.
Yeah.
And just feeling like, oh yeah, this is kind of not for me. Like this humor isn't for me. Culturally,
it's
just a kind of, yeah, it's just sort of
it's
not.
It's base.
Right.
A little coarse. Right. And so the immediate opposite of the Jerky Boys is, chapter marker here, folks, Longmont Potion Castle. Who is Longmont Potion Castle? Who is LPC? As I mentioned, he's a semi-anonymous dude from Longmont, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
What do we know about him? He's a metalhead that he started doing this stuff in the late 80s.
Oh.
And has continued to do it. Much like prank calling has gone through different eras, he too has had a sort of three-act structure of his art. You know, in the beginning, in the early 90s, he's using analog equipment, so there's this really wonderful hiss and saturation to these calls. And around 2008, calling the middle period, he's realizing that he is a sort of artist, and so that he can play in this medium. And in the third act, he's using something like Skype. And all the while, he's calling celebrities, and maybe we'll get to this a little later, but one notable one is Alex Trebek, which Futurelings may have been familiar with.
Well, you sent me some links, and I listened to some of the calls, and yeah, I admired, there were some, he was filtering his voice through some delay pedals, and
yeah,
I felt like,
yeah.
Just based on the reverb and delay and regeneration of the sound, I almost felt like I could tell which, like, pieces of outboard gear.
It's a DL4.
It was very, very much analog. Like he was, you know, getting feedback off of his little Fender Champ or whatever he was.
Yeah.
But you're saying that Longmont is still practicing this art form today. Now, what, 30 years into his career?
That's
what?
Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 25, 30.
Almost 40 years.
Who knows? Yes. Yeah. A lot of years. Some aliases he's used when he picks up, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of, you know, when he is asked, who is this? They're all different, mm-hmm. usually. Some favorites of mine include Pumpernickel Bracket, Spicy Legato, Flip Liquid.
Oh, yeah, Flip Liquid.
Shaquille Frick. And lastly, and I like the simplicity of this one, Brent Bump. The West Virginian really came out of me there.
It does feel like Brent Bump could be somebody from West Virginia.
Yeah. Oh,
Brent
I've met
Bump.
Brent. Yeah.
But I'm astonished that this person presumably also has a job. And you're saying as a longtime fan, you have no insight into who Longmont is?
I want to protect the mythos of this guy a little bit. There are some things that are known about him. That we've done some Kremlinology, which is a word that
some unknown knowns.
Oh, yeah. I got from your other podcast. So he's a metalhead. A lot of people in like the metal community, of which I'm a part, really love Longmont Potion Castle. The way that I got involved in all of this, the way I even heard about it, is sometime in college during my sincere period, my blue period. I went to school for music, but I went to grad school for rhetoric. And so,
come on.
Because I really wanted to make money.
Come on.
Yeah, something to say. Should we pause there? Should he make fun of me for that?
No. I mean, that's marvelous.
Right.
Graduate school in rhetoric. Did you, what is the highest level of education you have attained?
That is it. A master's degree, yeah.
A master's degree in rhetoric.
Yeah.
Okay. But did not become a lawyer. This and you.
I didn't become a high-powered lawyer like a lot of your other guests. I did find my way. There was a guest you had on recently who was in the tech world doing marketing. I do something like that.
I see.
For 50% of my life, and I'm in a black metal band for 50% of my life.
But it seems like with a master's degree in rhetoric, you could be accusing people of ad hominem attacks on the internet, like,
and doing it well.
Yeah, with an awful lot of confidence. Like, you're the classic example of somebody who's arguing on the internet and they're like, oh, that's a, you know, appeal to, and you're like, I literally have a master's degree
and
in
I'm
rhetoric.
All Aristotle said logos is the highest form. Yeah. I wrote my sort of master's thesis on Longmont and the rhetoric of prank phone calls, specializing specifically on the ethics. And in so doing, there were no repositories of transcriptions that I could draw on as a text.
Really?
So I started do we know this website? The sort of like wiki, it's not Wikipedia, but it's like the wiki for fandoms.
Yep. Wiki, I've been there enough.
Fan, wiki, something.
Wiki, dot, wiki fan. Dot,
wiki feed dot, fan.
Dot RU. Yeah.
Dot RU, one of the great subdomains. So I started one of those in which I created a wiki of everything related to Longmont, including transcriptions, which I cited in my own work. And I graduated. And I forgot all about a lot of this stuff. And I moved to Los Angeles in 2018, and I got a Twitter DM saying, hey, we really love the wiki. Would you be interviewed after Wise Blood as part of this documentary about Longmont? Like, oh my God. And so I go back to the wiki and it had grown. And it's so active even as I speak to you. It's my sweet small baby.
Wow.
So I was part of this documentary and this wiki still exists. I'm only setting the table to say, how did I find this stuff? Why do I care about it? Why should anyone care about it? Who's it for? Longmont Potion Castle, I'm going to put this really plainly, is for people who like language. Like, if you like to do silly voices, if you think the two words that I just said earlier are funny next to each other, spicy legato, if you're kind of voyeuristic, if that Instagram reel, TikTok, dopamine style of joy like speaks to you, Longmont is for you, I think. And I really like humor in general that is super time wasty. Like that's the highest form of humor.
Well, especially since time is so calibrated in your world, time wasty has that additional kind of unexpected, that additional danger. Right.
Yes.
That makes it like funny in a different way.
In the same way that seeing a movie in the middle of the day or a matinee while the sun is still out is just like doing a rude hand gesture to God.
Right.
Like just wasting sunlight, beautiful sunlight by trapping yourself in a windowless room. I think about time-wasty humor that way, which is like, it's heavy cream in my coffee. It is a decadent treat that I deserve. Because
right.
I'm so hard on myself. Otherwise, who knows why I like it? But
it's your birthday, and so you can go to the movies. Do you have a thing where you dole it out as little micro rewards?
Yeah, teaspoons of heavy whipping cream. Yeah.
Well, so let me ask a couple of things. One of them is, it seems like this, like if Longmont has now generated, or if your wiki brought all of these fans out of the murk. Mm-hmm. Why was there not already like a LiveJournal community of Longmont fans dating back to, I mean, considering his work dates to the 80s, it would seem that there would have been an online community already.
There does. I'm not to say if there wasn't, I don't think there was, but I think the quickest, easiest, best answer to this is, you know, I said earlier, I'm not a nerd. This appeals to so few people that the idea that there would be a community around it just like prima facie, like just does not you know, make sense at all. So maybe someone blogged about it. But as I think YouTube really started to populate, it was like Johnny YouTube seed, just populate Longmont to people like me. I think that's why. It's just like so unappealing, or it's so specific or so niche.
And the other thing I want you to explain culturally for our listeners who enjoy, say, for instance, Phil Collins, or Whitney Houston, many of the people in the world want to think of death metal communities and metal in particular being not a community of especially articulate critical thinkers. There's a lot of just sort of guar level monster imagery and apocalypse and murderous robots and stuff, even in the smartest death metal. I mean, if there's a murder robot, that you know that you're in the top 1% of metal lyrics. A lot of it is just like going through your purse or whatever it is.
Incorrect, but keep going.
Different band.
Yeah. going through your purse.
That's the Mentors. That's a whole different universe. But so can you describe, I know this community quite well because I'm on the fringe of it, but would you describe how wordplay and the kind of intellectual interest in Dada kind of surrealism and metal, and particularly like niche metal, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
How those cultures overlap.
You've cut some work out for me. I'm going to try to do this.
Okay.
I think the role of the symbol is in the Venn. You know, early Black Sabbath, you know, the devil, Satan, the titular Black Sabbath, you know, those fools weren't Satanists, right? And Cannibal Corpse, they're not out here
eating corpses.
Eating corpses or taking chainsaws to their loved ones or not, they're not so loved ones. Like, none of this is happening. It is about the feeling you get as that stuff is meditated on. I come from the black metal world, right? And so in black metal, there is an emphasis on and a real premium to the rejection of a superimposed morality. This is where we get, of course, the famous church burnings, this kind of thing, which is a rejection of the growing influence of Christendom over there, by which I mean places like, you know, Greenland, Scandinavia, Norway, whatever. And a lot of those folks aren't Satanists either. You know, some of them are. Some of them for sure are. But a lot of them marshal in anti-Christian themes as a kind of trolling, as a symbolic trolling to that that enforced morality that they didn't ask for in the erasure of paganism and their, you know. So also a bonus third thing is like death metal people and metal people in general are goofy. They're really smart, funny, goofy people. The punks and the hardcore folks, they're super serious. But the knuckle-dragging death metal drop G, nothing beyond the fourth fret communities have some of the smartest, as you say, smartest and funniest people in there. And I think these are people who culturally really appreciate contradiction, the unification of opposites, where there's this, you know, there's this imagery, you know, the shirt I'm wearing now, you know, you've seen Cannibal Corpse shirts with being
try to read the font. Try to read the font if you're over like 28 years old. Try and figure out what the hell that says.
Hypodontia is the band. I think that is a fear of not having teeth. Who knows? Anyways. these people care about contradiction as I do. Yeah. And I think, like, I've really liked really specific things all of my life. And these are very specific things that glue these communities together. And so, yeah, there's a real value on just, like, being goofy in a van and when you're in a band.
So here's the specificity. Yeah. In a way, it's like loving a band that no one's ever heard of. There's this prank caller that's doing this presumably not for profit, clearly not for pain, for fame.
Yeah.
Profit, when I say not for profit, do you agree? Or was there money in this in 1989? So,
yeah, right. Probably not. I don't know his motivations, but I do know that he, like, you could go to durecords.com, which is his record label, and buy Longmont 9, Longmont 11, Live in 25. He has, like, bundles and shirts. And one more thing about the cultural thing. Like, I think, like, liking Longmont Potion Castle is the Fernet of musicians. It is the secret handshake. Like, if you know LPC, like, you know that you're talking to a real one. Someone who could do bits, someone who's genuine, someone who has a good sense of humor.
On the internet, it describes Longmont Potion Castle as a musician. Is that accurate?
It is accurate in some of these records, and he numbers them usually. So Longmont LPC 9 is the ninth release, for example. There are metal interludes. He's a metalhead, right? So, and I think we don't know, but we think that he is a metal producer. I think that much is known, actually.
Oh, he's making records.
He's making records. Who knows which records?
It seems like if there was a really prominent studio in Longmont, Colorado, where metal records were being made, that this could be a clue.
The mythos is much more fun than being like, yeah, how big is Longmont?
You know? Right. You could book 2 days for $350 a day and get in there and actually, like,
do some calls. I'm sure you could. I've been to a live show where he calls in to the show and he asks people in the audience if they have any, you know, celebrity numbers and that he can do live over the PA, and it's a really cool experience. So I think, yeah.
And people in the audience are like, yes, I have Diddy's phone number.
I have Diddy's phone number. The same venue I saw you at last in Los Angeles, the Regent. I think it was the Regent. Someone had Anthony Kiedis's number.
Awesome.
That they give to whoever behind stage, but the person behind stage gives it to Longmont, and he calls Anthony Kiedis, you know, over the PA. So. The first type is Longmont. This is one of his specialties. Longmont loves calling business owners and people working at a business and service workers. And we know now in 2026 that, you know, service workers, these are not people who are super empowered culturally. Right. And, like, no bits on service workers. Like, it's not cool to, you know, someone's just working at Arby's, like, what, you know, leave them alone.
Right. Although there's the other side of that is they're getting paid either way, whether they're wasting. I mean, it's an example of their time is already covered with their $11 an hour. And in a world where time is money, they are poor.
Yes.
And so you're wasting their boss's money, really.
So one of the types, the third type we'll get to, is I see it as an almost a capitalist or a commentary on capitalism itself.
Right. Okay.
For now, service work. So this is in these calls, and maybe we just listened to Nash, in which he calls a record store. You know, he's weaponizing polite customer service scripts by obeying them too literally, like dragging reps into endless clarification loops that hollow out the idea of like helpfulness in general. And so the person on the end of the line is trapped between compliance and disbelief. We talked about decorum earlier, and that results in this like wonderful slow collapse of professionalism. And there's this like nice existentialism about it too, which is like, we're just two humans. Right now, you're acting as an avatar for a business owner, which you don't care about. As you said, I need to slice this soy roast beef either way. What do I care?
Right.
And so through these backs and forths, we're figuring out we're just two people, but you were pretending to not be. And I'm calling you out a little bit. It's a beautiful, beautiful dance.
But you have to feel as I do that listening in is also cringe. I mean, it's like it's annoying as F. Is that just me putting myself in the situation where I'm like, I mean, because I don't know how long it would take me to decide whether to say, okay, let's go together on this journey. Like, I'm with you. You're clearly like otherworldly. So let's play.
40 seconds.
Or is it like, look, I'm busy. And you're talking to me through a delay pedal. Like, this is clearly not, we're not having a,
but this is where the craft comes in, okay. Because he's usually there's so much variety. There are thousands of calls probably. But he's not hitting the boss DD6 moment zero. The boiling temperature only gets boiling through a few minutes. Yeah. This is the sort of manipulation. This is the sort of gaslighting. There's one, to round out this type of call, there's one business call that I really like. Actually, this could be a second type of call. The second type, let's do this, is the civilian type of call, where he's just calling people, as you mentioned earlier, phone book style anons. This is his sweet spot, and this is where he really loves to tell people that he works for UPS.
And that, oh, right, because that's the one we all are programmed to, like, oh, yeah. Shit, it's UPS. Like, oh, okay.
It hijacks. You're like, oh, my God, they're going to be so mad at me if I don't accept this package. You know, and it's time sensitive, so like, oh, I got to get home. There are a couple calls here I really like. One, I didn't send this to you, but I think it's just called Otis. So he's calling someone and saying like, hey, look, we got some CCTV footage of you hitting a few too many elevator buttons. And we cap it at 4 and you overtax the Otis system and we are expecting some payment. And I just like, just so good. And I think for that one in particular, a friend of his complained that this guy was like maybe not very nice to her. And that's how he called, you know. So
was a targeted.
He's chaotic good, I think, ultimately.
But do you hear the person start to try and replay their life and think, when was the last time I actually like
Oh, hit? Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It's so good. So in this type of call, he's treating everyday people as unwritten co-authors. So that's where the surreal premises and just refusing to resolve them at all, it just really becomes normal. And that's what's interesting is the power shift where like the civilian keeps trying to make sense. And, you know, by doing that, they're revealing how fragile common sense actually is. But the best one, to round this one out, the best civilian call is a call called Limes. I believe I sent it to you. It's a really early one. So the hiss is loud and it's just so beautifully analog. LPC calls a middle schooler. I think he's just calling a family. He's calling a home. The 13-year-old kid picks up. He accuses the 13-year-old of paging him and he tries to sell the kid a Super Nintendo. And the kid over time, we come to know this kid as a character. This is the three act structure, right? And this character emerges that he wears all black. And LPC is like, do you like goth music? And he's like, no. And he says, tell me something about school that you don't like, and tell me something about your parents that you do like. And over a few minutes, we get a really complete psychological profile of this kid who is vaguely suicidal and mentioned and discloses this. The kid's dad gets on the phone. Anyways, in the moment that the kid discloses that he's suicidal and thinking about ending it all, in a very rare moment of Longmont Potion Castle history, we see the dude, the actual human being who is Longmont Potion Castle, emerge. And he's kind of consoling this kid. And once he feels he's been satisfied by his consoling this kid, the consolation, he threatens to, you know, kick him in the jaw or whatever. This threat of violence, that serious, true, real-time pivot from, like, consoling this, like, this kid to threatening to kick his jaw with his cleat or whatever, I interpret as a kind of, like, that was an extremity that he wasn't anticipating, and his reflexes kind of kick in, you know, because we're already not in a script, and we're so far off script that, you know, the DNA just is the DNA.
Right.
You mentioned cringe earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, question for you. You know, I have friends who can't watch Curb Your Enthusiasm or even The Office. Are you that way?
I mean, I have to, when I analyze my relationship to any media, I always kind of have to ask the first question, which is, why am I watching this? Like, I believe me, my time, like, I wasted in droves, but I wasted with not a purpose exactly, an anti-purpose, but I'm conscious of my time and my attention as things that are precious to me. And if I'm going to waste it, I'm going to waste it on what I want to do, which is, you know, seeing how many Matchbox cars I can stack before they fall over or whatever. And so if I'm spending time with people who are in a movie or on a television show, why am I spending time with them? And like Larry David, I find is a good hang.
Great way to put it.
Like The Office, I showed The Office to my daughter the other day, The American Office. And after the fourth episode, she said, does this ever go anywhere? Is this just what it is? Do we just every day show up in this place and it's like this? And I said, I think so. And she was like, so why would we're not getting paid to work at this terrible place. Why would we go here? And I said, maybe we should watch Parks and Rec. Maybe that's a better office to have to go to. And what, as she asked it, I had to ask myself the same question. Like the British Office, it was so short and it was so novel that it felt like, I can't believe I'm in this place, because it resonates so much with things that no one had ever given voice to. Like, oh, these people are real. This is the world. But so in answer to your question, like, I don't consume cringe content in the same way that I don't really consume horror content, because what it does, because it is a form of horror content in a way, because what it does is it's like, it's toying with my emotions and exploiting my sensitivity in a way that just feels like, look, I can exploit my own sensitivity. I can be with myself all day. That's what having an inner voice is about. And so, yeah, I mean, that's my relationship with cringe. I don't like watching other people twist in the wind exactly. Except when you suggested that Longmont actually sometimes targeted bad people, like real life bad people, which it seems to me when we talk about the evolution of pranking, though our modern sensibilities would seem to be ones that pranking would be political always, that you would always be looking.
Well, everything's political.
Well, right. And so any prank that targeted anybody that didn't deserve it would be an assault, and every prank that targeted somebody that did deserve it would be an act of liberation.
Yeah. Right. Except you don't agree with that.
No, it's not that I don't agree with that. I believe that's, I don't want to jump ahead. Although all I can do is jump around like a rabbit on crank.
I ask about the cringe because I don't have an internal barometer that says, this is so hard to watch, turn it off. I'm pretty inoculated against that. So I was wondering if someone who is like normal in that way, how you would maybe like some of this stuff.
How do you feel about horror movies?
Love. I love Home Invasion in particular. Okay. I love all the body horror stuff.
From inside the house.
Yeah. I like to be titillated. I'll just say it. Sure. I think that's what we're getting at. Sure. I think cringe, you know, is a titillating feeling. It's very censorious. It's very, you know. Let's keep going, though, because okay. My promise to make this swift still stands. The third type of call for Longmont is the most interesting, I think. And this is where we start to talk about the political stuff a little bit. And by the way, I'm only referring to calls that are like freely listed on YouTube because although he is anonymous-ish, he's pretty protective of his work.
I can see.
And so this type of call is not really listed on YouTube. What type of call is it? It's the institutions. He's calling institutions. So we talked about, in the beginning, we talked about service work and business folks. We talked about civilians. Now the institutions themselves. So he'll call, there's some calls, well, he'll call a municipality or something about zoning, say. And this is where it becomes kind of academic. So,
but why wouldn't these be the main ones that were publicly available?
Because you have to go to DU Records and buy the discs buy the downloads. So this is the most pretentious I'll be, I promise, even though I did talk about black metal a little bit.
You do have a master's degree in rhetoric. So.
Correct. So I don't know if futurelings will have heard of Mark Fisher. Most known, he was a writer, most known, and now deceased, most known for capitalist realism. And so he paints this picture of there is no, I hope I get this right because there will be comments if I don't, maybe. He paints this picture of there really being no alternative to capitalism.
That, when you say capitalist realism, are you, is he or are you, differentiating it, or is it a reference to socialist realism?
Any type of alternative style? No, just the governing style.
Okay, gotcha.
Fascinating read. It's so good. I hope I got that right.
There's no alternative to capitalism.
Basically, that it is, and it catalogs a lot of the ways in which it punishes you, from the medical industrial complex to the bureaucratic complex. So there's this wonderful scene in the book where he's painting a picture of being caught in the phone tree when you call insurance or you call your medical provider as metaphor for the exhaustion of capitalism. So you get these automated menus, infinite transfers, the call being dropped as soon as it's escalated, recorded apologies. It's so good. Like, this is the mechanism. This is what capitalism does. It grounds you down. It grinds you down, not by force, but through process, through exhaustion. And when LPC is calling a zoning committee or whatever, he's turning. The mark is not the person answering the phone, even though that's what it sounds like. They're an avatar for the institution itself. So this is what we see in the sort of middle period of Longmont, where the people, the humans picking up the calls are just humans. They happen to have picked up. But the real commentary is the institutions and the processes themselves. And in this dude's head, in Longmont's head, he might not be thinking about it this way. Again, this might be the most pretentious I'll be here and the most academic I'll be here, but that's how I read it.
Is this you and your coffee klatch? Like, is there a whole level of Longmont critical theory?
I am the primary interpreter of his work. That can't be true.
That's
I'm kidding. But maybe, like, maybe it's me. And the folks who are fans of it don't think about it along these lines.
Yeah.
They think about it along the lines of, he said that he's going to whip someone again with his, or he said that he's going to, I don't know, that he's ordering hound bowel at a butcher.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's
hound
funny.
Bowel. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there are a lot of hound bowel calls. And to me, I hear that and I'm like, that's funny. But I'm thinking about it in a sort of larger, you know, power struggle, economic
right.
context as well. So maybe I'm the only one who knows.
How much of this is like denial of service attacks at the at a micro level?
There's some DNA there. Yeah. Is that a DDoS attack? But a denial of service attack, as much as I understand it, is that it, more than anything, is an inconvenience if it doesn't escalate.
I mean, it seems like a maybe one future of this is AI-generated robocalls that are calling customer service numbers so that all of these awful customer service situations get gummed by AI robocalls to the numbers, like, hey, I have a problem with my radiator. And although it would ultimately be inconveniencing all the people that had legitimate calls trying to get through, this would be a way of actually costing, this would be expensive to the bank or the hospital or the or Amazon.com because it would just be, it would be borking their system, which they're intentionally trying to bork to make it hard for us to live.
There may be a vigilante justice angle here that that we can't know because justice is about intent in part, right? So we don't know. You know, him, it's not well known that he called the Otis elevator guy to prank him because he was not nice to his friend who is a lady. But maybe a lot of these calls are like that and we just don't know. But the institution one is just so interesting to me because it's like a Samuel Beckett play where like authority can't escalate or resolve because nothing is technically wrong, you know.
Right. Cannot escalate or there's no way that because of the conventions, they can't say, "Feed off."
Yeah,
because they're the municipality of Springfield, Oregon, or whatever,
and they'll get a bad review or something. If
right,
you know. Anyways, okay. Swiftly.
Yes,
Jonathan Swiftly. Moving along to celebrities. This is the last major type of call that Longmont traffics in. It's admittedly my least favorite for a couple reasons. It is. I think. The fourth pretentious thing I'll say, the idea of celebrity, so over it.
Just kidding.
But a little bit.
Is it partly because celebrities are savvier and so catch on faster and are either more able to say, you know what,
beep
you, or I've got all the time in the world because I'm just sitting in a folding chair here waiting for my scene and so I'm going to play along?
I'm talking about the idea of celebrity at large.
Oh.
I'm not the biggest fan, but who are some celebrities he's pranked? Tons. My favorites are Gigi Allen. Got him before he passed.
You're kidding.
Oh, no.
How do you prank Gigi Allen?
Get this. Pranked Dick Dale, king of the surf guitar.
I mean, Dick Dale, I don't think he knew what zip code he was in for the last 25 years of his life.
Maybe. His wife mostly answers the phone and then, you know, refers him and then he gets. And finally, Sidney Poitier.
Yeah.
Cecil B. DeMille award-winning legend. And this is where he'll do the UPS persona again and say like, the call is called to Sir with Millipedes. He says, I have some millipedes waiting for you. And he's like, Sidney's like, wait, when did you come by? I'm sure my wife. And then, you know, he's saying, one of the millipedes just bit one of the guys on the dock. We really need to, and he's like, oh, come on. So like, from like a critical perspective, he's addressing celebrities as if they're just like another person, which is so beautiful to me.
Right.
And forcing them into the same sort of like absurdist framework as everyone else. It's a totalizing thing. And so that their celebrity status offers no protection usually. So the interest lies in like watching cultural power just like flatten. They have no power. And right, they're just confused.
They're used to having an assistant that's going to deal with this kind of phone call. And here's a guy that's just like, I'm on the loading dock with your millipedes and Sidney Poitier. When I listened to that call, you could hear him in his sun-drenched living room with his mid-century modern furniture and looking out over the haze of Los Angeles or wherever he's living. And he's like, honey, there's a guy on the phone about millipedes. I mean, it really did locate you in time and space in a way where it's like I could feel the air of Palm Springs around this guy. And it was this certainly the most interesting thing that happened to him all week.
Totally. I think I really like that you could hear people thinking on these calls. I think that's the voyeurism of it for me, too.
The one with Alex Trebek and Jeremy Piven.
Yeah.
Like those two are... Jeremy Piven is very savvy because he caught on instantly.
He's great.
And then Alex had a sudden... Talk about a dad. You know, he's just like, I think that this is some kind of shenanigan. And listening to Jeremy Piven... So excited to be on a call with Alex Trebek.
He was a gamer. He was such a gamer.
And really trying to like be gentle with Alex and also at the same time wanting really to put Longmont on blast.
Yeah.
But it being so, it's a three-way call and it was brilliantly done because he's like, I've got so-and-so on the line and then so-and-so on the line. It could have been like a real brain.
Beep. This is a specialty that he doesn't do all the time, but it's a, if any of this stuff is cringe to me, this is the closest it gets where he will, this is so devious, he will call someone at Radio Shack and then put them on a three-way call with someone at Orange Julius across the mall or whatever, or another Radio Shack. And then he will connect them and then shut up. He won't say a word. And he will leave it to them to figure out what's going on. This is the format that he pranked Trebek and Piven with.
Right.
It's so devious. You know, I was thinking about our conversation earlier about like the ethics of this and wasting time. You know, I understand your mom is kind of a character in a lot of the John Roderick universe. She's a force of nature.
I just saw her walk by outside here. With her, she's outside the bunker now in her jumpsuit, and as far as I could tell, was maybe carrying a big reel of hose. I'm like, what are you doing? What is even? But anyway, so she's here
working hard.
Yeah,
yeah. So if like I mentioned harm earlier, that there's a type of harm here. So like as you are fight or flight scanning and indexing every so if like. You are worried about feeding your kid because money is tight and you get a UPS call demanding money for a shipment. Like that sucks. And if someone called you, let's say your mom and was like, hey, here's a medical scare. Like, I don't know, like that feels wrong. But what's really wrong is that I don't think that's evil or I don't think that's wrong, right? Like there is a utilitarian calculus here where I'm like, if the call to Sidney Poitier or to a record store is taking money from someone or is taking someone's time who might not have a lot of it left on earth, that's a kind of harm. But if I think it's funny, I'm good with it. And what does that say about me? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. You're finding, well, that's what we do, right? We find value where we find it. And yeah, if somebody gets pranked and it wastes an hour of their time, but it gives an hour of joy to 1,000 people, it's the trolley problem.
Yeah. Yeah. What this is kind of maybe interesting me in is, am I fine with unethical things if they serve me? Mm-hmm. And this has implications every which way, all the way down. Because, like, we are inoculated, most of us, unfortunately, to the horror of what being unhoused is and means. I live in Los Angeles. I see unhoused people. And, like, yeah, I try to help when I can, but, like, I'm basically inoculated. I'm, like, hashtag part of the problem, right? Like, it serves me to be like, you know, there's a house down the road where I know they sleep, so they're fine. Like, that is really awful. And I know I'm not alone feeling that, but.
Well, this is the difference, as you were saying, between the kind of humorlessness of punk rock and the Dadaist,
the metal
feeling in metal. When you think about trying to be ethical and all the different levels of challenge in being ethical, like the ethics wars are kind of like the integrity wars. We're in ethics wars now. I lived in integrity wars days, but I always come back to the statistic that last year 9 million people died of starvation. So when I think about all of the levels of responsibility that we have to one another, and the number of fights that we get into over microaggressions or whatever, when 9 million people are dying, I mean, literally starvation being both one of the worst possible ways you could imagine dying and also one of the most easily solvable problems. It's just a logistics problem. And the United States military of all, just for one, talking about UPS, like, logistics is a massive thing of modern life. We're shipping wool to China, knitting it into sweaters and shipping it back to America to sell those sweaters for $12. And yet we can't find a way to distribute food to 9 million people that are starving to death. So when people get upset about, like, anything, basically, in modern life, and like, how can I live in this house when two blocks away there's somebody that lives in a less nice house? It's like, 9 million people died of starvation and I did nothing about it today, and you did nothing, and and we're all just sort of like, talk about turning a blind eye.
Yeah.
So that's you know, my hot take on, like, what are our ethical obligations and where the line between, I'm just trying to get from my whipped cream on top of my coffee to bed tonight without feeling like I'm a waste of space. That actually is real too. You know, it's maybe not, well, how do you gauge? We talk about this all the time, right? How do you gauge what's the realer of the two things? And how do you say, like, my things aren't real? And so I have no right to sorrow.
Mm.
Where we all have a right to sorrow.
Yeah. We solved it all just in that. I think we did it.
I don't know if that, I don't, I want to hear the, la- I want you to end on the future of pranking. Yeah. Because the big pranking of 15 years ago was the, it wasn't Keanu Reeves. It was the other cute boy that, tall cute boy that pranked all the rock stars, on TV.
Oh, Ashton Kutcher.
Ashton Kutcher, where he was.
Yeah. Punked.
Yeah. Punked. He was actually, like, really infuriating famous people for our pleasure. And that show,
That's cool. That's the actually, Lord's work.
It really was. And also the guys that did the terrible stunts where they shot each other out of the cannon and they kicked each other in the balls.
Jack Butt. I know we can curse, but yeah. It's funnier.
Yeah, that's right. Jack Butt. there was quite a bit of pranking in that too. Pranking just normies and even the way they pranked each other, where they had to know every day they woke up, they had to know somebody was going to kick them in the balls. And yet,
yeah.
And yet they always got caught out. But that feels that feels so 15 years ago.
It really does. I can only kind of speak, I'll speak to the prank phone call aspect of, okay. rather of it than the general aspect of it. So when it comes to telecommunication and pranking using infrastructure, I used this phrase earlier, it's a closed form. The millennial or not, the presumption of sincerity is gone. It's been erased in the last, whatever, 3 or 4 years.
Whoa, really? You really? Is this a Gen Z thing? Or is this just the world has gone sideways enough that sincerity is no longer...
The latter. I think it started with deep fakes. It started a long time ago, but I think palpably, you know, AI, bots, deep fakes, all of us getting however many calls per month that our iPhones... you know, helpfully say potentially spam, like
right.
it's a grift everywhere or something, yeah. or it's Russia or whatever. So because that has collapsed, like this art cannot evolve. It is done. In as much as the omnibus is an archive of things past, I think basically the project of Longmont Potion Castle can't evolve after this. I hope I'm wrong. But for me, that's kind of beautiful. Like harpsichords were so like, I love thinking about this, that Bach never played on a piano. He never left Germany. He never played on a piano. He only played in, you know, not in churches, but a lot of in churches. And he played on harpsichords.
That were tempered weirdly. We don't even understand how they were tempered. Yeah.
Yeah. And they got replaced by the pianoforte. They got replaced by in the salons or whatever. And right. like, but we now can go to Baroque thing. You know, like we could still celebrate this body of work because it is so good and it will evolve. Like sincerity, and I feel like you were very articulate on this, sincerity will find a way. I think you believe in sincerity. I think like a little dandelion in the cracks of... you know, the bots and irony of the brutalist architecture of it all, like it will find a way. And when it does, you know, LPC or someone like it will be there to pluck that flower.
Well, I really do think that in the next decade, we're going to need to retract not just the number of people that have access to us, but we're going to have to retract from having unlimited access to everything. I can no longer... handle the amount of media I have access to because I no longer believe any of it is real or has any information that I need, but I still have access to it. I still am compelled and I need to have artificial walls now or self-constructed walls. And once we start building those walls again, where we say nobody comes in here that can't verify themselves, I'm not letting anybody contact me. I'm not consuming any media that isn't verified. I'm putting a blue check mark on everything that comes in the door and it's not one you can buy.
Yeah.
Then pranking again is trying to get into a walled city, right? The pranking is going to have to pretend to be somebody. It's going to have to find a new way to be UPS, right? Because I'm going back in a way to the landline. As I retreat, it yeah. opens this possibility.
In the upcoming apocalypse, during the upcoming apocalypse, we will have a ham radio system. And that will provide a beautiful canvas for pranking to occur. It's the best format for it. Last thing I'll say, you know, there are still comedians doing this stuff like Mary Houlihan, Johnny Pemberton, Neil Hamburger has a few discs of prank calls. Like there is still a culture. Yeah. He's so great. But yeah, I think it'll find a way to evolve. And I hope we're there for it.
And that concludes Surrealist Prank Calls, entry 1258.OB0102. Certificate number 50858 in the omnibus. Futurelings, as you know, and as we discussed on this show today, there's nothing good on the internet, and you should avoid it at all costs. But if you are going to go to the internet, there are a few verified locations that I'm going to give you right now where you can get actual content that has been handpicked for you by us. And the first one is you can watch this episode. You can see Aaron and me talking to each other in real life on YouTube, of all things, youtube.com/TheOmnibusProject. You can go to Facebook, Instagram, Reddit, Discord, elsewhere by searching Futurelings. We're at Omnibus Project in a lot of those places. Futurelings are 100% a sincere group of people. There's no goofing around of any kind. You can email us to theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and we will read your emails and do our best to address them on our monthly addenda shows, where we, yeah, not only read your emails, but also, I guess, we're going to increasingly start reading your social media comments. And you can access that addenda show and many other benefits by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject. And become a supporter of the show. You can go to, you can actually submit, as Aaron did, submit to be a guest host on the show by going to our website, omnibusproject.com, and you submit your show proposal to omnibusproject.com/submit. And finally, you can mail us real mail, and I don't have any real mail here. I want more real mail. But you can send us mail to the Omnibus Project at 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, B-U-R-I-E-N, Burien, Washington, 98166.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in The Omnibus.